Well, we're going to need to start off with some more banter.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, I feel like
I think it's probably the best thing that we do, and even though we just did it about 15, 20 minutes ago, it doesn't feel stale.
No, it feels stale. Like all the years that we've been doing this, our banter has never run dry.
In fact, I think we were like, oh, wait, there's much better. Hi there.
Hi. Hey.
Wow. Welcome.
Good evening.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Know It All with Tay and Kay. I'm Tay.
I'm Kay.
And, well, last time we regaled you with the extraordinary tale of the creation of the greatest nation in all of creation.
The United States of America.
This is by no means a short tale.
So if you're just joining us today on your commute or while doing household chores or by sitting by the fire with your children huddled close, take a big step back and think about what you're doing.
Because this episode is part two of an epic three-parter about the Founding Fathers! So where do we leave off?
The Brotherhood of the Eagle was just formed in full.
Brit hunts came and went.
Paul Revere had just completed his ride into the annals of history.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Well, polish those muskets and sharpen those bayonets, because this war is on!
Taylor, I think that some of our listeners may be having difficulty wrapping their heads around the preposterous idea that the British were ever a threat to American sovereignty.
Well, at the time of the American Revolution, the English held the most powerful land army in the entire world.
See, every time you say that, I can hardly stifle my laughter. Please go on.
No, let's just laugh a little bit more.
It's on?
Yeah, okay. It's on. As we've discussed, warfare in the 18th century was a gentle affair. Over the course of nearly 8 years of military conflict, the total casualties for the American Revolution on both sides totaled under 80,000.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's a walk in the park compared to Nam. That's baby's first haircut compared to the French Revolution.
Well, military engagements in the age of gunpowder were quite literally walks in the park, except with firearms.
To counter the superior resources of the English, the colonists took to utilizing tactics that were considered downright revolutionary. Taylor, were you facing your bitterest enemy on a broad, grassy pasture, would you simply point your guns at one another at an appointed time, take aim, and fire simultaneously?
I suppose I would only do so if the social expectations of the era demanded such a thing.
Not in America, they don't.
Oh, well then I would hide behind a large rock and fire wildly in the opposite direction. And if there were nothing to hide behind, I'd probably run around a lot, possibly throwing in some Aikido rolls in there for good measure, also while shooting. I may also cry. But what I wouldn't do is stand there and wait for my opponent to draw his weapon, nod my head in agreement, and fire my inaccurate pistol at the same time as he.
Taylor, with your layman's understanding of modern combat, you would have killed hundreds of Englishmen. Fortunately for you and I, the colonies capitalized on English gentility from day one. Take the Battle of Lexington and Concord.
Otherwise known as Hancock's Triumph. Take us there.
April of 1775. After years of excessive taxation, the colonists had had enough, and through secret channels began to train a militia in the hopes of defending themselves from another Boston massacre. The English knew about our secret plans, but with the help of Paul Revere, Washington knew what the English knew, and when you can fire about one bullet every 2 minutes, knowing is significantly more than half the battle.
In the following letter, King George attempted to persuade any potential revolutionaries to give up their plans before any blood was spilt.
My children, it would appear that we have reached a breaking point. Let it be known that the milk has not run dry, and that my bosom is open to your war, and that you should lay down your arms and accept the fluffy shackles that are my many taxes. I will unbutton my shirt for you. The dutiful payment of heavy and omnipresent taxation is a cornerstone of British citizenship. It would seem that proximity to the savages has brought out in you, my children, an anarchic streak that demands all the benefits and protections of crown rule without the acceptance of its onerous financial burdens, let me assure you. There is no hope for your kind without the strong breast of Mother England to suckle my young colony. Were you to relax your grip from my heavy, drooping teat, I have little choice but to thrust the other into your crying mouths. Let it be known that it is known that my spies have revealed to me the locations of your militia training grounds, your weapon stockpiles, and your pathetic attempts to cover them. No quarter will be given to those who resist my mighty lobster backs. I shall not tolerate for long what appears to be a desire to create a sovereign nation. And my dutiful servant, General Cornwallis, shall bring doom to any who so much as attempt to raise arms against their mother king, who seek to unfetter themselves from my loving, breast-filled embrace. What will you even name your nation? Washingstan? Hancocktia? Frankland? That's basically what they used to call France. You can't do that. Accept your taxes and my love, or die. Your loving lord, King George III.
In a stunning public rebuke of the king's demands, John Hancock personally hired over 2,000 town criers to disseminate this message throughout the 13 colonies.
Enterprising lads, are you strong, handsome, and unemployed? Are you full of impotent rage and a frothing hatred for all things effeminate? Are your teeth clean? Then you may be just the man that the sovereign nation of Hancocktia needs in its fight against the cowardly King George. Your courage will be greatly rewarded. A sturdy blunderbuss, your very own war pony, and, should you survive, a house to call your very own. Fail to do so, and all other neighborhood boys will laugh at your mewling English foppiness. Join my boy brigade, and the next hero of Hancocktia could be you!
Cornwallis preemptively stuffed the towns of Lexington and Concord to the brim with fresh troops and told them to turn over every house, every wagon, and every tarp they saw in search of munitions. And when they did, Hancock's fabulously dressed boy brigade was there instead, muskets armed and ready.
Most people can't stay hidden under a tarp for even a minute without being discovered, but the colonists had a trick up their sleeve. They could. This is where they get the name Minutemen, a far better name than Lobsterback.
Little known fact. The British had dubbed themselves Lobsterbacks out of some sort of misplaced pride.
The British continued to be fooled by tarp after tarp, and one English general, Hugh Percy, was personally victimized by over 7 tarps before he caught on.
Well, the English simply weren't used to trickery on this scale, and thus the Boy Brigade secured America the first victory in their now official armed conflict.
Honorary Founding Fathers?
Who, the Boy Brigade?
Yeah.
No, a founding father, honorary or otherwise, must be a man, and even 500 boys couldn't produce in 1 hour the surge of testosterone that pulsed through Washington's brain every single minute.
I just feel that they deserve a little more recognition.
They'll get it, but it will take many more years of hardship and suffering.
Well, if you want to talk about suffering, can we talk about what happened to the Lobsterbacks at Bunker Hill?
Otherwise known as Breed's Hill.
Yes.
Cornwallis ordered a day off in honor of the royal puppy's birthday, and the normally hostile English army stationed in Charleston, Massachusetts, decided to turn Breed's Hill, a popular canoodling spot, into a picnic ground.
Checkered blankets were thrown, and savory puddings were had by all.
Savory puddings?
Oh, well, they're a staple of the 18th century English diet, yeah.
What flavors did they have?
Well, let's see. According to the colonial records, they had, mustard.
Gross.
Yorkshire.
Huh?
And bread.
Weird.
I know. For decades, local teens had been secreting themselves away on the dark side of Breed's Hill in order to privately hold hands and share sensual sonnets. Leave it to the English to confuse it for a picnic table.
The English picnic grew to an enormous size, covering the entire sunny side of the hill with gobsmacking buffoons. The town looked on in horror, knowing that their pubescent young were on the other side, mere inches away from an entire battalion of hostile soldiers.
The following is from the diaries of John Adams.
Dear reader, I am sure that you, like myself, are a man of culture and refinement, and that the descriptions of teenage sensuality taking place upon that hill may appear at first unnecessary. But in order to fully grasp the going-ons of the Battle of Bunker Hill, I feel that I must indulge you.
They are profoundly graphic.
And not at all necessary, so we will, in fact, skip them. He continues.
There they came upon the sight of teenage debauchery lain before you in the previous pages. Soon every English soldier was peeking over the crest of Breed's Hill. I seized the opportunity and rounded up a force of 50. They opened fire upon the hill. The Englishmen returned the volley, and our men were overwhelmed. Immediately the lobster backs resumed their leering. I then ordered an attachment of men and a host of local harlots to arm themselves, relocate to the hill, and disrobe, whereupon...
It goes on. For pages.
Finally. Continuing.
They opened fire upon the leering eyeballs. Row after row replaced them, hoping to sneak a peek at the writhing masses of supple young flesh. Until ammunition was in such short supply that the order was given not to fire unless one could see the whites of their eyes. Soon the salivating lobster backs could barely contain themselves. They rushed down the hill in a suicidal rabble, directly into the awaiting bayonets of the Harlot Brigade.
The Harlot Brigade was one of the most successful military units in the early American history, with over 900 confirmed kills among just 27 women.
That's 33 and one-third kills per woman. Honorary founding mothers?
Without a doubt.
This seems like as good a time as any to hear a word from our sponsors.
Agreed.
Kevin! Kevin, it's me!
Well, who could that be?
Kevin, it's Taylor! Hey, let me in! The big game's on and my cable's out!
I would, Taylor, I really would, but unfortunately I simply can't until next week's paycheck comes in. You'll have to continue speaking to me through the mail slot.
Why? Just open the door.
Impossible. Not without incurring a hefty bill for a new frame, a new set of hinges, and a new battering ram. This one's about to fall apart.
Well, why don't you just use the knob?
The what?
The knob! The little handle that lets you easily and effortlessly gain access to any room, anywhere, without having to destroy the door itself.
Sounds too good to be true. What if I don't want someone to get in? I mean, for all their inconveniences, my knobless doors sure keep the intruders out.
Easy, you can just lock it.
Like a treasure chest?
Exactly.
Sounds like the perfect way to protect my children.
The only real treasure.
True.
Doorknobs. It's an open and shut case. The war was waging on the front lines. Benedict Arnold and George Washington made an unparalleled team, which made the British's single-file lines of soldiers quickly obsolete. It began to become more and more apparent that the war was turning in our favor.
The time to declare independence was at hand. After Arnold's continuous insistence that riding a horse into the middle of the battlefield and loudly exclaiming, "Independence!" was not sufficient, Washington sent this letter to John Jay on April 3rd, 1776.
John, I need you to gather up Jefferson and write us a statement of freedom. Something like a declaration of independence, but not that. Tell him to think of something better and then just write it. Jefferson gets a little flowery with his language sometimes, so make sure that Adams helps him out so we don't sound like a nation of dandies. I know they don't get along that well, so get Madison as well, lock them in a room, and tell them he can't leave until they're done. Got it? And in response to your inquiry, I am aware that the paperwork that you have mounted this month alone will take many sleepless nights to get done, but we can't hire any helping hands. The risk of them being insurgents is just too high and not worth jeopardizing our mission. We all have to make sacrifices. Suck it up. My best to, Mildred? Yours, George.
John Jay spent the next month and a half on horseback, gathering the three different men from three different colonies, as no messengers could be trusted with letters of summons.
John Jay owned a nice, fully furnished cabin in rural Virginia where he led the three men.
The founding fathers were all men with very strong personalities. Some of these personalities melded together perfectly, like Benedict Arnold and George Washington. But sometimes these giant personalities clashed, and no two founding fathers clashed more than John Adams and Thomas Jefferson.
Adams was a man of words. He was a man who didn't carry a blade because his tongue was his sword, and he had a gun anyway.
Jefferson would goad Adams into a rage by responding to his inquiries with sexual gestures so detailed that Adams usually had to excuse himself for fear of vomiting.
Now, these two men were confined to a very small space in the very humid spring air of rural Virginia with Madison there to referee.
In a mere 4 hours, Jefferson and Adams had burned down John Jay's cabin.
Madison carried the two fighting men to safety and dragged them to John Jay's office, who was meeting with Ben Franklin.
John Jay, you ignorant quinny! What do you think in putting these two animals in such a combustible hut to do business and putting me in the middle of it?
What are you talking about? What are you covered in?
Soot, Jay! It's soot!
From what?
Christ, from the cabin, genius! These mongrels burned it down. Now get out of here because these mutts need a new place to play.
You can't do it here. Look at all this paperwork. It's a tinderbox.
Fine. Come on, kids. Let's take a jaunt down the road to the John Jay residence.
No. That's okay. Take the room. Come on, Ben. Let's continue our discussion of post-revolutionary social reconstruction elsewhere.
Nah. You've got it. I'm gonna stay right here.
The transcripts of the actual writing of the Declaration of Independence, as well as John Jay's office, were completely destroyed during its inception. All we know is that 11 hours later, when they all emerged from the remains of the room, Jefferson's hair had turned completely white, Adams's right hand never worked again, and Madison carried, tucked under his arm, a floorboard with the now legendary document carved into it.
The drafting of this document was a huge blow to the British, inciting this response from King George III.
My children, I read the Declaration of Independence. I am deeply hurt. Deeply. For generations, my family has toiled over you colonies. We have coddled you and provided for you and asked for so little in return. You want to vote? You want independence? You think you can get by without us? Let me tell you something. Voting is overrated. It brings with it all sorts of civil duties, consequences, red tape, discontent. And don't even get me started on Parliament. A bunch of bewigged corpses shaking their canes at one another of the crown jewels. Seriously. I bet if I put you in Parliament for just 5 minutes, you would walk away saying, yes, taxation without representation is a pretty sweet deal. Obviously, since you've never been there, you do not share my sentiment. In response, I have sent another 10,000 troops to New England, which, judging by the name, is the only part of the colony still loyal to the crown. The entirety of Parliament law has been painstakingly inscribed on every bullet carried by my lobsterbacks to help educate you of the vulgarity of democracy. When you are ready to come home, the door will be open. Love, King George III.
King George sent this letter foolishly underestimating the colonists' resolve for independence. Rather than gathering in New England to get a formal education in British politics, our founding fathers saw this as a golden opportunity to win a decisive victory for the colonies.
The place in question was Saratoga, New York. George Washington sent Benedict Arnold under the command of Horatio Gates to Saratoga.
Well, why do you suppose that is? Gates was not in the Brotherhood.
Chain of command. I mean, Gates was a superior officer in the military. It went without question, though, that despite formalities, Arnold was really in charge. I suppose Gates could have pulled rank if he had to.
Which is exactly what happened.
Right.
Diary. Gates is proving to be a rather irksome bedfellow. I returned to our shared officer's tent this evening, riddled with fresh bullet wounds and totally exhausted. Gates was still in his bedclothes, reading pamphlets and scribbling crude illustrations in the margin. It was clear to me that he had slept in and missed the battle. He said,
"Is it over already?"
And I threw my boot at him. Another day of fighting lies ahead of us. Another day of bloodshed and mayhem.
The battle continued for another day, and this time Gates was afield, issuing orders in his pajamas from his horse-drawn bed. Arnold was right behind him, correcting his mistakes and taking full control during Gates's many mid-battle naps.
To be fair, Gates was very old.
After a messy transition, Gates excused himself to go to the bathroom, and Arnold knew that this 45-minute reprieve was all the time he needed to secure victory. At minute 44, the English were completely surrounded.
Gates then emerged from his mobile latrine to the sight of General Burgoyne kneeling in surrender. Gates gladly accepted his saber and dismissed Arnold from the battlefield, saying that he looked tired and could use a nap. Arnold stormed off and wasn't seen until the next meeting of the Brotherhood.
How did he know when that would be?
I'll answer that and any other mysteries that are plaguing you after a quick word from our sponsors.
My, Taylor, that new fad diet you've been on is working like a charm. How much weight have you lost?
12 pounds. My clothes barely fit anymore. I mean, these pants will fall right to the floor if I let go of them. Watch.
And no underwear either.
No, never. I may look great, but ever since I lost all this weight, I haven't been able to use both my hands without my pants falling down.
How long has that been?
About 2 weeks. You'd be really surprised how often you use both of your hands, but until I have enough money to buy a whole new wardrobe, that's my life.
That's terrible. Unless...
Unless what?
Nah, it's stupid.
What is it?
Well, it's a long shot, but maybe you could get a belt.
Yeah, I'm way too old for karate lessons, Kevin.
You're never too old for karate lessons, A. And B, belts of all sorts are now available through other means than martial arts merit.
What? Since when?
The Bronze Age. They even have belts made of things other than colored fabric.
Say what?
Sure. Leather, hemp, nylon, polyester, duct tape, aluminum, colored fabric, or rhinestone like the one I'm wearing.
Whoa, that's a belt? I thought those were just some fancy city pants.
It's a belt, and it reliably keeps my pants from inadvertently falling off.
You know, I think I'm actually going to get myself a pair of those other things that hold your pants up. What are they called?
Suspenders?
Yeah, I like suspenders, actually. I'm gonna get some of those.
Oh, yeah, cool.
Suspenders! Keeping up your pants and way cooler than belts, and you know it.
John Hancock spent 2 cumulative months drafting letters and campaigning through the colonial heartland in an attempt to persuade 329 important colonial sympathizers to support the revolutionary cause. In the end, only 48 gave a positive response.
After a prolonged period of similar forms of wheedling, Hancock managed to assemble all 57 founding fathers at what would become known as the Second Continental Congress.
Their intention was clear. Unite the colonies under a single set of rules and laws.
The Articles of Confederation.
Taylor, I would go so far as to call them the Farticles of Confederation.
Kevin, I would go so far as to call you hilarious.
Yes.
Continue.
Any issues one may have had with the original draft of the Constitution would look minuscule in comparison to the disastrous document upon which our nation was mistakenly founded.
From the transcript of the May 7th meeting of the Second Continental Congress.
Order! Order! Quiet down, all of you! Come on now, fess up! Who wrote this in here? No one. None of you. I find it hard to believe that the words possession of the crown goes to whomsoever is able to exterminate the current king magically appeared overnight. I thought we were past kings.
I thought kings were still on the table. I've been lifting weights regularly since the idea was thrown into the ring.
Lift all the iron you want, Hancock. I've got hawk eyes ever since stealing Franklin's bifocals, and I'm going to pull it till it goes click.
Which is once, until someone invents a repeating rifle, or some man is able to reload in a single minute. The fat end of my hammer is the last thing any of you will ever see.
Plan your assassinations later, gentlemen. We must work together first to kill King George. Only then will any of us be eligible for kingship of Washington.
Hold on! Kill King George? Where did you get all these lunatic ideas? Do any of you understand succession law?
A full minute of silence descends upon the room. Jefferson rises from his seat, and with a sweeping series of gestures, the silence remains, but the awkwardness is gone. Scattered applause.
Thomas, thank you. Gentlemen, if we are to prevent the tyrannies of the crown from occurring in our homeland in the future, we need to be willing to experiment with a more democratic means of selecting a leader.
another silence.
So, we all fight at the same time.
I could agree to that.
Yeah, totally.
That sounds pretty good.
The final document was clumsy, contradictory, and confusing. The preamble contains no less than 6 references to asses. 1/4 of the laws are related to the sale and exchange of show ponies.
And with all the scratched out parts, it's virtually illegible anyway.
This document, it's as if you deliberately designed it to fail. It's completely unsalvageable.
You said that all we had to do was secure power and authority to the Continental Army, and then we could write whatever we wanted.
It will have to do for now. Well, gentlemen, lock up your ponies, because until we come up with something better, it looks like we're all assassination targets. And apparently, everything we buy will be taxed. Do you see why I'm upset? Starting a revolution because the king chose to tax some of our products, and now we've somehow taxed literally all of them.
That may have been a bit much.
Not property.
Thank God we ran out of space. I have a lot of property.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I already told you. Right?
The following day, Thomas Jefferson gave a riveting performance to the Second Continental Congress, moving them to begin ratification of the Articles of Confederation.
It is sometimes hard for us in our modern era to imagine the Revolutionary Army. This is America, and we have the greatest and most powerful army in the history of the world. So we have a perverted, idealized view of the military. Taylor, when you think of the army, what immediately comes to mind?
Oh, tanks, bombs, helicopters, new metal, aircraft carriers, M16s, soldiers walking in camouflage in tight unified lines.
Many of those things weren't even invented at the time of the American Revolution, even helicopters.
At the time, our army more closely resembled a group of Revolutionary War reenactors than anything modern men would call combat ready. So, while colonists were savvier fighters, they lacked the experience and resources of the Royal Army.
You are infantilizing our forefathers.
Where else do you think we get the term infantry?
Interesting.
We wouldn't have the now legendary Continental Army until these young boys were carved into the hardened men of revolution. And what better place to do that than the Valley Forge encampment, where Washington's troops held up for the harsh 1777 to 1778 winter.
Held up? This is war. They can't stop the fight because it's a tad chilly outside.
This is ye old war, Kevin. You must remember that. These men didn't have a codified system of operations. They didn't have uniforms. A third of them didn't have shoes. Mm. The encampment they did set up was done with 12,000 men using just one axe.
Whoa.
Exactly. These fragile boys of war had taken their first step towards becoming men. They set up camp and held out without proper supplies or backing or rations, clothing, food, water, through 2.5 months of brutal winds and endless snowfall.
Okay. That is pretty cool, but they still weren't fighting.
They fought an enemy far more terrifying than Mother England, Mother Nature, who took the lives of 2,500 men. The suffering, the courage, and the sacrifices of the colonial army spurned the colonial citizens to give their support. Valley Forge, while not a battle, transformed our militia into a military.
Our forefathers were made of some tough stuff.
Taylor, you're looking a little sleepy.
Oh, Kevin, even the most thrilling account of the Valley Forge incident couldn't keep me awake right now.
Well, that's good, because now that you mention it, all this history is leaving me feeling a bit worn out as well.
Yeah, it's pretty convenient, because I think it's about time to leave our listeners with a little cliffhanger.
But fear not, we won't leave you out to dry like we've done for the last few months.
Sorry about that.
And I'm sorry to you, Taylor, about that, about all that listener mail that's been piling
up.
It's
like a fortress in my atrium.
You know, Taylor, I'm just going to go out on a limb here, reach into the pile, and read whichever letter I pick out first.
Great idea.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. This letter comes from Cassie Brandeis. Yeah. And she comes from Rio de Janeiro in steamy Brazil.
Ooh, I'll bet she's gorgeous. Hi, Cassie.
She says hi. Dear Tay and Kay, I was wondering when you were going to come out with a new episode. It's been several months, and I use your podcast to help me learn English. Love the show and love you guys. I can't wait to hear the next one. Love, Cassie.
Ooh, love is a strong word, Cassie.
You don't even know us.
And as a married man, while flattered, I am unable to respond to your amorous feelings, so Kevin, could you field this one?
Sure. Cassie, when a man loves a historical period, sometimes he loses himself and forgets his friends and what he really cares about. As a probable mango saleswoman or soccer player, you may not understand the demands that history, that high-maintenance mistress, places on us. So, while we are sorry for the delay, we are not sorry for our patriotic zeal. I hope you learn something about what makes our country so great, and maybe you can use some of the lessons herein to improve your own country. So, Taylor.
Oh, he's already asleep. Okay, so, well, thank you for listening. And join us next time for the final part of our three-part series on the Founding Fathers. This has been Know It All with Tay and Kay.
I'm Tay.
And I'm Kay. Thank you. This episode of Know It All with Tay and Kay was brought to you by Gravel.